You are listening to That Hoarder, Overcome Compulsive Hoarding. Learn about hoarding disorder from me, somebody who has it. I promote a better understanding of hoarding disorder, a stigmatized mental health condition that is mocked rather than treated with compassion. I want to change that, and by talking openly and honestly about hoarding, I hope to start conversations that help. Find out how to support the podcast at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support. Finally, I am not a doctor. I'm just a hoarder doing her best. So do seek professional support if and when you need it. So I am here with Jo Cook. Jo is the author of Understanding Hoarding, Reclaim Your Space in Your Life, and the soon-to-be-released Overcoming Chronic Disorganization, Finding Strategies That Work. She is also the director of Hoarding Disorders UK and an accredited member of the Association of Professional Declutterers and Organisers. Jo, how are you?
Hi, I'm really well, thank you. Really well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on. For listeners, Jo and I have been chatting for ages, and I was glad to finally have an excuse to get her on the podcast. So how did you first get into the area of hoarding that led you to be in the position you're in now?
I know. I sort of didn't grow up thinking I'd help people too much stuff, but I think as a child I was nosy. I think as a professional we would use the word curious. Yeah, I got into it after my dad died. My dad was Polish. He grew up during the war. He hated waste. He remembers his parents sacrificing their food to give to him. So we'd have to eat every grain of rice on our plate growing up. But my mum managed him and, sort of edited, curated as we went along without him really noticing. But she died way before him. And he said, right, well, you're not touching my stuff. You can sort it all out when I'm dead, which we did. Or I did mainly, and I've got four other siblings. So it took me 4 months to clear the family home out. You know, we didn't just have one log shed, we had three log sheds. We had, you know, he kept all his old cars and tools galore. And then I realized that, you know, there was, you know, I was quite good with dealing with stuff, quite good with dealing with people. And I didn't realise that there was an association of people that help people in their homes. So I took I took redundancy from the Department of Education and set up my own business. And then I realised that, yes, there is hoarding. Yes, there is clutter and disorganisation. And I think that we I realised that, you know, that we need to look at all of those things very differently. So that was 10 years ago that I set up my own professional decluttering company, but also Hoarding Disorders UK. So it's a 10-year anniversary of not only hoarding being recognised as a mental health disorder, but 10-year anniversary of being part of a community interest company.
Amazing.
So 10 years on and I'm still here. We're still here.
Going strong.
Very much involved in understanding the research. I think you do more research than I do. But, you know, just very pleased to be involved in unpicking. And I think it is really unpicking and unpacking. You know, we talk about the meaning in the mess. You know, what is happening in someone's environment that contributes to it not serving in a home that serves us anymore? You know, what are the implications of someone's environment having on them physically and mentally? So looking at that and really pleased to share that knowledge with other people. So I think, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years now and just recognising different patterns of behaviour.
So given that you have such specialist knowledge of hoarding and that was what your first book was about, what led you then to the field of chronic disorganisation for this second book?
Well, I think I began to realise in the homes I was working in that it was, they would often present as hoarded homes. But when you started to challenge people in terms of, you know, whether or not they wanted to let an item go, they go, oh, yeah, no, that's fine, that can go. And actually, you know, I began to realise that I wasn't seeing as much shame as I was in other people with hoarding behaviours. I know it sounds funny, but I think there's a lot of, and we've talked about this before, someone with hoarding behaviours wouldn't go, oh, yes, please come and help me. Whereas someone who's chronically disorganised will go, yes, it might be shame, but it's like, yeah, I've got myself in a pickle. Oh, yes, please come and help. So I was recognising more of a trend of my client base in terms of them having suffered a bereavement, or their son might have got a diagnosis of ADHD, yet they might not be seeing their own ADHD. And a lot of those neurological conditions that have gone undiagnosed. But also I seem to sort of attract menopausal women. And I'm thinking, yep, that's me, and helping them through that. And I think hearing through the professionals that I'm working with, they'll go, well, you know, we got them to tidy up, but then I go back next week and it's back to being messy again. And I'm thinking, yes, this isn't because people, you know, it's not that they won't tidy up, it's that they can't tidy up. And recognizing that.
Yes, 100%. I really appreciated the sections and mentions of menopause in the book, because I think there is a bit of a societal thing happening where people are starting to talk more openly about menopause. And you're seeing that with various, you know, celebrities talking about it and that kind of thing. And I think this way of looking at it beyond what is going on with your hormone levels to how is it affecting your daily life, and starting to apply it to things like chronic disorganization, is really new as far as I can see.
Definitely. Yes, I think chronic disorganization was mentioned in the States quite a long time ago. In fact, there is an institute of challenging, you know, organization. But I think in this country, more and more, we're beginning to talk about issues that in the past would have, you know, we would have found shameful. So people are going, well, yes, actually, my brain doesn't behave in the same way it was. And I think a lot of people are going, look, this used to be my filing system. Now I'm lucky enough if I can throw it into a box file. So I think the book, I wanted to sort of say, look, I'm not giving you a perfect life with a perfect pantry and a perfect body. But to say, look, you know, yes, we might all be impacted by disorganization, but actually let's be kind to ourselves and recognize this isn't about you being, you know, lazy. It's not about you being stupid. Yes, we will have days where it would just be really difficult to do the laundry, to do the washing up, to, you know, whatever it looks like, just coming to terms with those day-to-day tasks can take everything out of our vessel.
So chronic disorganization often involves clutter, but also other aspects of life as well. I wonder if you could talk a bit about how you would define chronic disorganization and how it affects people.
I think when we define chronic disorganization, without having to go back into my book to find the definition, I think it's when there are sort of huge attempts at people trying to put systems in place or not having any systems, where it really impacts their day-to-day living. So, for instance, you know, getting your children to school on time. I think for many people, there will be issues over time management, to perhaps having the right uniform out and you know, staying on top of daily tasks like laundry. I think remembering to pay the bus penalty fine that came in, or remembering not to drive in the bus lane for starters, to getting tax returns not in on time. Some people will have huge attempts at putting systems in place. So they may well buy lots of box files, lots of filing solutions. Oh, yeah, this is going to be the perfect solution. They'll find a box file, a concertina file, they'll buy a filing cabinet. But actually, none of those systems work. And it'll be the same as storage boxes. Yes, I found the perfect storage solution. I'll buy this pink box. No, pink works better than clear box. And no, I'm going to get round ones. I'm going to get ones that stack, but don't actually put anything in it. So there's that with the attempts of being organised, to not having any systems in place at all. So where, you know, for the 15th time, you know, they haven't been able to, not the 15th time, but they haven't been able to go on holiday because they can't find their passport. You know, they haven't been able to spend Christmas with their loved ones because they can't find their car keys. You know, and I think that can really impact not only on people's personal lives, but also their professional lives as well. Not being able to achieve those everything that they're meant to. So, you know, can often be chastised for poor timekeeping or not getting projects done on time. So I think it's a huge area. And I think we can all be impacted. Situational, it can be inherited, it could be, you know, linked with neurodiversity. Anything can tip us over the edge. Sleep deprivation. I mean, try wading through life on 2 hours sleep.
And having read your book over the weekend, I slightly made myself laugh by spending the 10 minutes before this call panic searching for my headset and my water bottle, both of which I found, both of which were within reach of where I'm sitting, but could I find them? Oof, it took a while. And so, yes, it felt very apt.
Yeah. And I think there are days when we just feel like, you know, we can't get our act together, yeah. You know, and I think that is to, you know, that's our brain. You know, there's so much going on that we need to just calm the chatter down in our head to be able to go, right, okay, I can do this, you know, whatever that looks like. I'm working with one lady, she's got a storage unit of dirty laundry. That is how overwhelmed she is. You know, when you look at even the simple tasks of laundry, I think you've covered it in one of your podcasts.
Yeah.
Huge.
And it's so constant that you can never feel fully on top of it because you know that by tomorrow there'll be more.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are the links between chronic disorganisation and hoarding? Like, would you say all hoarders are chronically disorganised or are they quite separate?
I think there's a huge overlap of hoarding with chronic disorganisation, certainly in the homes that I've worked in. But then some hoarding is very neat and tidy.
That's
and also obsessive. But I'm seeing more of the chronic disorganisation. So, you know, as if you're going in. So I think that is huge because someone will buy the same item twice or three times because they can't find the first one in the first place. But I think it's understanding. Why hasn't someone got 8 pairs of secateurs? Are they hoarding secateurs? Or is it because they can't find the first one in the first place? But I think there is many links with hoarding and chronic disorganisation because I think it's, and I know you covered this before, all to do with this sort of the executive functioning, you know, of our brains in terms of the ability to organise, to plan, to prioritise, with the decision making and the overthinking. I think those are real. Perfectionism, I think they are real traits of people with hoarding behaviours. And then you've got the thought process of why we keep our things. But I think there are strategies. I think there are strategies in terms of approach things and reframe things. But also, I think when we can start to not feel rubbish about ourselves and feel shame and feel that we are stupid, I think that is huge in terms of being able to adapt things to the way that we would like. And I think that's where support groups come into play, because when you've got that me too, that feeling of me too, I'm not the only one, I think that can be huge. Connecting up with other people that know exactly what you're going through.
And you mentioned it there, as well as connections to hoarding, there are a lot of links between chronic disorganisation and ADHD and executive dysfunction. And I really like that you dedicated quite a chunk of the book to executive dysfunction. How would you say that struggles with executive function make chronic disorganisation worse or exacerbate it?
Well, I think it's just the ability to recognising the challenges that you have when you have executive dysfunction. Anyone can have executive dysfunction. It's such a lofty word. I wish they'd find something that made it easier for people to understand. You know, it just sounds so big and complicated, and it's not. I mean, executive dysfunction is when, you know, if you've had 2 hours sleep, we can all be impacted by sleep deprivation. You know, if we've had, you know, drunk a bottle of whiskey the night before, we can all be impacted by executive dysfunction. Having a baby and going through menopause, but also, you know, in terms of the, you know, any type of grief that we might be going through, depression, all of those can impact on our ability to just get up and to be able to do things. And it is those simple, and we're using everything in our, you know, everything in our vessel just to be able to, whatever it might be, to be able to do the washing up, to be able to put the rubbish out. So I think some of the strategies that there's this lovely theory called the spoon theory. I don't know if you've read about it.
Yes.
You know, right. So today, if I've only got, you know, 9 spoons, how am I going to use those 9 spoons? And then recognizing that some days we will have more energy than others, depending on you know, the factors, what's going on around us, and that's okay. But also recognizing that actually my best energy is first thing in the morning. So don't ask me to do anything after 4 o'clock because my brain is just mush. So recognizing that too. But also the importance of looking after ourselves, you know, and what we put into our body and how we look after ourselves, you know, impacts on our ability to manage life. You know, from, you know, I know that if I was to eat a packet of Haribo sweets, I just wouldn't be able to do anything. You know, just the impact it has on my body. Or if I'm dehydrated, I know I can't think clearly enough to get stuff done. And it is about getting stuff done.
I was struck that a lot of the things that cause or that can cause chronic disorganization is another area where there's a lot of crossover with hoarding. You talked a lot about kind of grief and trauma and loss. What role do you think those kinds of things have in chronic disorganization and hoarding?
I think they're huge. I mean, I talk a lot about COVID and the impact that had on us. For some people, you know, if they were impacted that, you know, in terms of finding it a traumatic experience with a big T or a little T. For others, it was like ideal time to get their act together and sort their homes out. But I think we're still seeing the aftermath of how, you know, COVID not only impacted on our sense of loneliness, on our behaviors, on our ability to think with clarity, just because that not knowing what's going on into the future impacted a lot of people. So I think we're still seeing the aftermath of that. And I think it led a lot to a lot of grief, as we said, and living in anxious times, anxiety, even when we're worried about, you know, the cost of living and have financial concerns, as well as concerns over, you know, any anxiety. I think any overwhelm as well, when we are overwhelmed, and I don't think there's enough done to address the chronic overwhelm that we feel, can lead us just, you know, we can become stuck and paralyzed with that. And I think technology hasn't helped. You know, we're living in this fast-paced life and there's expectations to be this and do that. And then you've got labeling and perfect pantries and perfect bodies and then, you know, the best vacuum cleaner to have in our home. It's just too much. And then technology, you know, it allows us not to be able to focus on the things that we want to. So we flit. We find it really difficult to stay focused on any task. So I think one of the tips I gave, and I still think it's a huge one, is the body doubling. I think body doubling with someone on any task, whether it's maintaining your home or, you know, doing a difficult email, I think just having someone alongside you, just being that quiet cheerleader, can be huge. You know?
So come along to the Dehoarding Accountability Zoom session.
Absolutely.
On Sunday.
Absolutely. You snuck that in really well.
You set it up perfectly.
I think it's going to be great.
So, yeah, I'm excited.
No, that's really good. But, yes, I think body doubling on certain tasks can be huge. You know, and then not looking at, you know, look at the challenges. Don't look at things that are weaknesses. You know, that kind narrative, I think, is really important.
This podcast started as an outlet for myself, but 200,000 downloads later, it's somehow become much more than that to a lot of people. I hear from people that me talking about my experiences and interviewing specialists and experts is helping them too. Hearing those stories makes the time and cost absolutely worth it. But if you want to help to ensure that the future of the podcast is sustainable, you can donate to help with costs. To send a one-off or recurring donation, just go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/donate. Thank you. You mentioned there about kind of flitting from one task to another, which I can certainly relate to. And two of the things you talk about in terms of ways to manage chronic disorganization are sustained attention and goal perseverance, which seem to be quite related to each other to me, and also seem to be something that a lot of listeners will struggle with. Mm. How can we improve our sustained attention and goal perseverance?
Sustained attention, you know, just staying on track, staying on task. Again, that body doubling can help because, like, no, we just got one more page of this film, this form to fill in. I think that, but I was working with a client the other week, she had Mozart blasting through the house, and actually that there's something called the Mozart effect. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I've heard of it. I don't know what it is, but I've heard the words.
There's certain music that has been suggested, or researchers say, can be really add to being productive. So there'll be, you'll find it again, it's finding a rhythm. So there are bits of Mozart that you will get into a rhythm on, and then that can keep you on task. But I think sometimes sustained attention is actually eliminating all the distractions. So I think sometimes people, because I can see my clients that, you know, they're looking at this and then they're down a rabbit hole of looking at Chinese takeaways when they're meant to be sorting out sewage issues with Thames water. So I think it's you know, learning to put your blinkers on in a way to go, right, when I get to this, then I can have a cup of coffee. They're really chunking things down. And I think that's when you can stay on task, knowing that if I just do this for this amount of time, then I can go and watch some snooker afterwards. And that's my reward system in place. So I think, yes, sustained attention is huge, but recognizing when you're getting distracted or it's too much, chunk it right down.
Yes, because you can't expect to have 8 hours of sustained attention on one, you know, it's, there's realism involved, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah, there is. So I think just saying, right, I'm just going to do 10 minutes of this and then give myself a break, rather than, you know, just if you were to say, right, I'm going to do all my filing on bank holiday Monday, you're never going to want to do filing again. And you're going to dread every bank holiday because you remember the time that you did filing all at bank holiday. Just break it down, chunk it right down. Goal perseverance, I think if the goal is strong enough, and we always talk about, you know, it's not the motivation, because I think I think it was Jan that mentioned motivation can be fickle.
Yeah.
I think it's understanding that actually the goal has got to be strong enough to be able to stay on it. So that create that vision, but bear in mind that, yeah, it's nothing to do with being consistent. It's nothing to do with discipline, but it's looking at make sure that the goal is there and strong enough. And I think when the goal is big and strong enough, then all of those bits of executive functioning can come into play.
And it took me a long time to work out that for me, having a goal of a clear home that friends come round to is too far and too big, and I can't equate what I'm doing today with that. And so for me, a mixture of short and medium term goals work better than the big one. And for somebody else, it may be the opposite. They can't be bothered with a short term goal, but having the big goal in mind is what they need.
But I
think there's so much emphasis on what do you ultimately want that it took me a while to realize that for me, I have like an image of what I ultimately want, but that isn't what I need to be focusing on the day to day.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it's going back to those, and I still believe in those SMART, you know, the whole, it's got to be specific, it's got to be measurable, achievable, realistic. But I love the three T's: timely, tangible, and tiny. tiny, tiny, because we start tiny, and that is, then we can get, and I think even like we talk about tiny habits, tiny goals, tiny tasks, you know, it's all about, and then by doing that, you're building in your own confidence. Yes. And building in that sense of self-efficacy, you know, and I think sometimes it is that confidence. It's like, you know, well, how do you run a marathon? You start off by walking in your trainers, you know, in your living room. So that couch to five, you know, that sort of,
yeah,
you know, I think that's, that works for people. Yeah. But we all have, we're all motivated in different ways. There's no set, right, we've got to do it this way. There's so many self-help books out there. I mean, there's thousands of them, but I think it's, yeah, find your internal goal and see what that looks like. But yeah, there's no right or wrong way of being able to achieve what we want to do, but it's finding our own method and not beating ourselves up, you know, if it's not done in the way that we originally thought it might do. You're going to get blips along the way, you know, ride the blips, the high tides and low tides.
And your goal might not be what people expect your goal to be, and that's also fine. You might have different priorities to what the world expects your priorities to be. But if you're working towards something better, that's always a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
So in the book, you identify a lot of different types of procrastinators.
Yes.
I won't ask you to list them because there are dozens.
I thought they were great.
They were amazing. And so I wondered if you wanted to, you know, pick a couple and talk us through a couple that apply a lot to people who are chronically disorganized or who hoard.
Well, I like one of them, yes. So the lovely Janie contributed these to my book, and she's a coach. I love the one distracted procrastinator. We talked about sustained attention just now. So in distracted procrastinators, even though they may have clear goals and intentions, the bright, shiny object syndrome takes over. It could be interruptions from others or distracting thoughts or Instagram rabbit holes. I think we talked about rabbit holes. They get, or rather allow themselves to be pulled away because there are so many better things to be doing other than what really needs to be done. So I think that's that one of them. Dopamine deficient procrastinators. Again, I like that one. These procrastinators are on an unconscious quest for a dopamine hit. While doing what they need will give them that. It's not now. They need it quicker. You know, and I think I see that a lot in the clients that come to support group that I've worked with, that email us all. But yes, I think we can all procrastinate, can't we? We want to be going out to play, not working. And I think people procrastinate over things that they deem are work.
Yes. Can you explain the PACE approach? PACE standing for playfulness, acceptance, curiosity and empathy.
Yes. Yeah, so Donna talked about that. And I think it is around, again, exploring and being curious about our own behaviours. So I asked Donna to write about this. So the PACE, we talk about playfulness, and I think it's understanding that shame and joy cannot share the same space. So actually, I think if you can bring playfulness into certain situations, I think that can be really helpful. So we talk about that in the book, and I think it's, again, just being curious about our own behaviours and why we do what we do, or why we put off what we do put off. And again, understanding I think one of the big things that's come up in the whole 10 years that I've been working with people is understanding what our tolerance to stress is. We talk about distress tolerance, and I think that is huge. I think we're all avoiders of something that feels uncomfortable. And I think that is just plays a huge part in, you know, whether it's, you know, decluttering or de-hoarding, I know you like to use the term, or doing those day-to-day tasks, but not looking at them as day-to-day tasks that feel boring, feel tedious, but actually what I really liked, and I know you interviewed her recently, well, not calling them daily tasks, but calling them care tasks, Who was the person that you interviewed on that?
Katie Davis.
That's right. She's brilliant, Katie Davis. So I think understanding that just looking at them as a care task rather than daily task, I think is a huge way to just reframe our approach to our environments. Yeah.
And I think also acknowledging that while doing the tasks or getting rid of stuff or any of those things can be anything from uncomfortable to very distressing, also living in a hoard can also veer from uncomfortable to very distressing. So it's not like by avoiding the tasks you're avoiding distress. You're just picking a different distress.
Yeah.
So if people are listening and they are recognizing themselves in the kind of chronically disorganized people you're talking about, what are a couple of steps you would suggest they start to get more control over their life?
I think accepting help or asking for help and actually defining what that help looks like. I think with the best will in the world, people have gone, you're just itching to go in and make it spick and span and how beautiful, oh, that feels better. Actually, that can be really disorientating for people. Our nests are all very different. So actually for someone to come in and unpick that nest can feel quite vulnerable. It's like, what are you doing? So I think asking for help and looking at what help looks like and defining it, I think, you know, is a huge part. But also, and I keep saying that, you know, join support groups, you know, the support groups, you know, join the virtual de-hoarding together. I think they are huge. Because we mentioned before, when we can start to bring the shame down, Brené Brown talks about shame beautifully, then that's when things can start to happen. And I think it's that, well, if you can do it, so can I. And I think being inspired by other people's progress, whether that's, you know, being able to put a hook on the door for your keys, that always, where you always know where your keys are, or being able to let go of that Radio Times from last week. I think accountability and sharing those feelings together with other people is a huge part of moving forward in a positive way. Yeah.
And many years ago, I was in a support group for something for something not about hoarding. And it was something that we all felt a lot of shame about this thing. And a lot of self-blame and self-recrimination. And there was something very powerful about that process where every week I met with these same people and I could look around the room and go, well, it wasn't her fault and it wasn't her fault and it wasn't her fault and it wasn't her fault. So for it to suddenly, for my bit to all be my fault, it was really stark. The double standard I was applying to myself. And the main thing I got from that group was that I really challenged that belief that I should be ashamed, even though every other person in the room shouldn't be ashamed. And it's hard, when it's that stark, it's hard to maintain that sense of shame.
Yeah.
So, Jo, first of all, how can people find you online? Secondly, how can they find your book and when does it come out?
Well, thank you. So, yes, I think the best place of finding me online is my hoarding website, hoardingdisordersuk.org. We're a community interest company. You can just Google Jo Cook Hoarding. There is another Jo Cook that comes out that does wedding gowns. I'm not that Jo Cook, by the way. So. I'm the hoarding Jo. And I'm the hoarding Jo. And my book is available online, Overcoming Chronic Disorganization. It's ready to pre-order. It's being published on the 20th of June. I'm actually having a little book launch, but that's in Devon, if anyone's interested in that, in East Devon. So, yeah, I'm very excited about it.
You should be. It's a great book. Having read it, I think it's got lots of practical, applicable stuff. It covers a lot of ground and it looks at chronic disorganization from a compassionate lens and also a comprehensive one.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed writing it, actually, and it's packed full of lots of case studies. So I think there's a lot of relatable material in there that I think people can go, yeah, that's me. Oh, good, I'm not the only one. Again, as we talked about before.
Definitely. Okay, Jo, thank you. That's been so useful. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
So, shout out this week to the Speaking of Psychology podcast. This is a little mini clip of a guest called Samuel West talking about failure. Have a listen.
There's a quote that I've stolen, and I have absolutely no idea who said this, but I love it. It's not failure if you call it an experiment. So, and I mean, there's, yeah, you can laugh, right, at it, but there's something really good,
no,
to it.
It's true.
If you design it as an experiment, say we've done our homework, we've got all the information we need, we're going to take a risk that when it fails, it doesn't damage the organization or cost lives or suffering. We're going to test it in a realistic environment, see what happens, and if it fails, hey, great, let's learn from it.
It's data.
That's data. To me, that's the most brilliant type of failure.
Now, of course, I will link to the Speaking of Psychology podcast in the show notes at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. And let's try and think of things we're scared of failing at as just an experiment to gather data. Let me know how you get on. Okay, thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you next time. Thank you for listening to That Hoarder Overcome Compulsive Hoarding podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on board. You can find all the links I've mentioned and a transcript of the episode online at overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk. To find out more about how you can support this podcast and the overall project, go to overcomecompulsivehoarding.co.uk/support. And do subscribe to the podcast so you make sure you don't miss any future episodes. There may be links in this podcast that earn me money. This doesn't come at any extra cost to you if you make a purchase through those links, and it helps to support the podcast.